Hello, it's Nigel, and welcome back to the Crew of Japan podcast. In today's episode, Doug and I are sitting down with Rob Dyer, the founder and CEO of The Real Japan, a company which helps travelers plan their trips and itineraries from A to Z to Japan. In this episode, we discuss Rob's first time visiting New Orleans.
And there's a police car pulled up right next to us with the sirens going and the lights flashing and all this kind of thing. And then literally a guy they were chasing rolled over the hood of the car being chased by police officers.
How Japanese cinema sparked his interest in Japan.
But it was really those classics by the Japanese masters that really got me interested in Japanese culture, because, you know, you could see what everyday life was like in, you know, the quiet parts of Japan. And that's what really, really drew me in.
And some of the most fundamental things travelers should keep in mind if they want to get off the beaten path when they travel.
I want to sometimes say to them, look, you know, you've got a really busy schedule that week. Allow an entire afternoon where, you know, you're in Kyoto, but you literally don't have any plans.
Our conversation with Rob Dyer is just ahead. Welcome back to the Crew of Japan podcast, a weekly podcast where we take you on audio journeys through Japanese culture. Today's episode is part one of two of our conversation with Rob Dyer. In part one, we get to know Rob, and we talk more so about the philosophy behind off-the-beaten-path travel. In part two of our discussion, we dive deep into the Kansai region and give you specific places to visit on your next journey to Japan. Without further ado, let's jump right into it. Okay, and welcome back to the Crew of Japan podcast. Today, we actually have a really awesome topic. We are revisiting our travel topics, and today's episode is actually on the Kansai region, but not just the main sites. Today, we're talking about off-the-beaten-path options that travelers have when they visit Kansai. And to help us on this journey, we actually have a very special guest, Rob Dyer, who is the founder of The Real Japan. You may have seen him on social media. We've reshared his stuff on our Twitter multiple times. But Rob, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
And we also have our veteran co-host, Doug.
Good morning. Oh, actually, it's just morning. I don't know if I would call it good. But
well, Rob, we're going to actually hand it over to you to kind of introduce yourself to our listeners and give you a chance to talk about who you are and The Real Japan.
Sure. Thanks. Thanks, Nigel. Yeah. So my name's Rob Dyer. I live in the UK. I was born in England. And I've been exploring Japan since the year 2000, actually. My wife is Japanese, and we were married at a Shinto ceremony in Ikuta Jinja in Kobe. That's one of Japan's three oldest shrines. And I started blogging about our travels in Japan when friends were just asking us for recommendations on where to go. I'd run, and I still run it on the side, a music blog, which I've been doing since 1999. So that was pretty ancient. So I was used to blogging, and I just thought, oh, okay, I'll do something on Japan. But then TheRealJapan.com was started, and within two or three years, it became a full-time business. So now, aside from sharing sort of ideas and inspiration on the site and to my subscribers, I also offer travel planning services to help travelers explore Japan kind of beyond Tokyo and get a little off the beaten path. A lot of the people that subscribe have been to Japan multiple times, maybe five times or more even. And really what they've done is they've kind of done the major cities, Tokyo, particularly Kyoto, maybe Osaka and so on. And they're looking for that first bit of getting off the beaten track. So gently nudging them into that direction. So that's what I do with the website.
Wow, wow. And so this music blog is new to me. I didn't know this. What type of music?
This is interesting because we could pick this up. I wasn't going to cover this, but it is actually relevant because it is how my wife and I actually met originally. It was, so the music is kind of the stuff that I'm quite into, which is anything kind of electronic or alternative. So I was a kid of the 80s, so I grew up with all the synth pop stuff that was coming out of the UK at the time. So yeah, so that's the, awesome. That's kind of what the site covers.
Wow. Okay. And do you cover any like Japanese like electronic music at all, or?
A little bit. Yeah, not that much. There's not actually that much that comes out of Japan, or certainly not that much that I'm overly familiar with. There's a few artists that are reasonably well known, and certainly for a few years ago there are. But there is another blog that I know that specializes in Japanese stuff, but that is more like the heavier rocky side of things, which isn't really my bag generally.
I gotcha. Wow. Fascinating.
so you said you met your wife through the blog or through music? You just kind of connected that way?
Well, actually, the
if you,
the origin
if you want to go into, I'm sorry.
Actually, I was going to pick this up, actually, looking at one of your questions. But the origin actually goes back to one of the bands was Depeche Mode, an English band. I don't know if you've heard of them.
Yes.
But my wife and I were both members of the Depeche Mode fan club. And this is kind of pre-internet days. So they used to have a club fanzine, like a magazine. And it used to go out to all subscribers, members of the club. And there was a pen pal section at the back. And I already had this interest in Japan. So I just wanted to write to anybody in Japan, basically. So that's what I did. And I just started corresponding, old school, long handwriting letters to a bunch of people in Japan. But over time, they sort of dwindled. And only one person kept writing. And that was the person, the woman that went on to become my wife.
Okay, that's absolutely
that's incredible.
Amazing. Yeah. All right. So, have you licensed off that to become a movie yet, or are you working on that?
No, but I'm open to offers.
Yeah. Hey, it'd be a great one. Now, that's all I'm saying.
So before we jump into because I know you had more to talk about with your Japan journey and everything, but before we jump into that a little bit deeper, one topic we usually bring up, one of the first questions we always have for our guests is their connection to New Orleans. We're a New Orleans based podcast. Our audience is for the most part, kind of international at this point, but initially was targeted towards a New Orleans based audience. So have you been to New Orleans before? And if you have, what's your fondest or funniest or most unique memory? And if you haven't, what's the first thing that comes to mind when you hear New Orleans?
Okay. So yeah, I have been to New Orleans actually. And it was in 1997. During my so far only trip to America. So, and I was just thinking about, I was just checking the date today. I think we flew back on this date in 1997 back from there because we wanted to spend Halloween in New Orleans, but we couldn't because the accommodation was all booked up and so on. So we spent a week in New York City first and then moved down to New Orleans. So, yeah, I mean, the whole thing with Halloween, I'm a big Halloween kind of fan. I love the Halloween movies. And so there was a really great vibe. And obviously there was the decorations and the pumpkin carving was going on and everything. So and I love the food. So having spent a week before in New York, I got really bored of fries with everything. So when we moved down to New Orleans, I was really glad to have some really, gorgeous food. So that I really enjoyed. But in terms of standouts, there's a couple really, but the one that struck me straight away was because it was kind of like we were in New York at the start of October, so it's like 10-11 degrees, big city, tall towers, lots of shadows, very cold basically. And to be honest, I found New York to be just another big global city, so I've traveled quite a lot internationally, and then I didn't find it that distinctive a character. So I was really kind of like on a bit of a downer. So I was a bit kind of gloomy, really. And here in the UK, the autumn and winters are grey. And it was kind of like that in New York. And I thought, this is not like getting away. So then after like a 5-hour flight, which made me realize just how big the US compared to the UK is, we arrived in New Orleans and it was in the evening by that time. And obviously everything was aircon. So from the plane right through to the arrivals lounge, through customs and all that kind of thing, and getting to the airport exit. So it was only when we got to the exit doors and the doors opened, automatically, and it was only when I then stepped outside, it was so hot and humid, and it felt like somebody just thrown a hot, wet towel over my head. And my reaction was, great, now I feel like I'm on holiday. You know, I really, because this is different. This is what I wanted from America. Nice. And so you need to remember, this is kind of back in 97. So back then, here in the UK, we were seeing reports on the news of, you know, the riots in LA and all these other US cities, and it seemed like crime was rampant. And, you know, and we, honestly, we were a bit almost naive, but we were absolutely kind of a bit nervous about the trip. You know, because of all this stuff we were seeing in the media and so on. So it was evening when we arrived, and we had a cab, got a cab to get to the airport, to get to the hotel from the airport. And we were just driving away. It was pitch dark. It was raining, a bit, you know, humid and all this kind of stuff. And we just came to a screeching stop all of a sudden. There's a police car pulled up right next to us with the sirens going and the lights flashing and all this kind of thing. And then literally a guy they were chasing rolled over the hood of the car, being chased by police officers. And so, you know, to these English people who were a little bit nervous, it's just kind of confirmed our prejudices of what the mass media have been feeding us about. You need to be scary if you're going to America at the moment. So I knew from that moment onward that our kind of trip to New Orleans would be a memorable one. But, honestly, it was fine. I loved every day that we were there, and I really would love to return someday. So, yeah, that was quite a memorable introduction, and I, you know, the adventure had really started by the time we got there.
Yeah, the you saying you walk out of the airport and get punched in the face with that humidity. I used to travel a lot for work, where I'd fly out of New Orleans and then go up to Minnesota, which is like northern Midwest of the U.S. for those who aren't familiar, and there it was like in Fahrenheit, like -5 degrees in the winter. So that's, I think that's like -10 or lower in Celsius. And maybe it's like -15. I don't know. Cold. So I would go there. I'd be wearing like 18 layers of clothes. And then I'd go to the airport to fly home, get home, and it's like 80 degrees. So it's like
it was exactly the same thing.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. So I can totally relate to that. And if you do come back, I'm pretty sure British Airlines has a direct flight now.
Ah, right.
From Heathrow, I think, to New Orleans.
That would be great.
There you go. Yeah.
To your experience of a guy rolling over the hood. I mean,
it was just like something out of a movie. It was so unreal.
I was going to say, is your entire life a movie? At this point, I'm convinced.
Maybe I'm in the Matrix and I just don't realize it.
Or the Truman Show. I don't know.
Dropping heavy hints, but I'm still not getting it.
Exactly. So you actually mentioned a little bit of your interest in Japan. You were doing a pen pal thing, which you eventually met your future wife. But what led to your actual interest in Japan in the first place and eventually you traveling there?
Yeah, so I guess it probably all started actually when I was a young kid just watching Godzilla movies.
That'll do it.
You know, like the old black and white ones from the 50s from Japan. And I've always been a big film buff as well. So for just over a decade, I published a film fanzine and I was a member of the British Film Institute in London. So they would have regular seasons of Japanese cinema. Modern, but you know, they used to do a lot of the classics, and I particularly like older black and white movies, and especially when the ones were in Japan, the ones that depicted like the Showa era, because that's an era that I'm really interested in stylistically, aesthetically, and you know, culturally. And I think watching those films, you know, Godzilla was my hook into the sort of the field, but it was really those classics by the Japanese masters that really got me interested in Japanese culture, because you know, you could see what everyday life was like in, you know, the quiet parts of Japan. And that's what really, really drew me in. So then I just started to read loads of books about Japan. So again, this kind of, you know, this was a kid growing up in the 80s. So this was pre-internet. And I just read anything that I could about Japan. So originally, I started reading about Japanese cinema, history, culture, economics even. Basically anything I could get my hands on just to learn more about it. And I've always traveled a great deal. I like traveling. So, you know, it was inevitable that I would go to Japan, combining the two interests. And it was towards the end of the 80s, actually, that I had the Japanese pen pals. And as I say, they slowly dropped off, but one kept on corresponding. And she also loved traveling. And so she would take lots of short-term jobs just to kind of save money. And when she had enough money, she would leave her job and then go traveling around the world, or, you know, to go to a country or a continent or something like that. And whenever she came to the UK, we'd meet up. And because we had similar tastes in music, we'd go clubbing or to gigs, that kind of thing. And this just kind of happened over a number of years. And so she went on to become my wife and live with me here in the UK. And of course, so then I had family in Japan. And so we visited them, as often as we could, really. So that's kind of, you know, I married into Japanese life, yeah, almost, you could say.
Yeah, wow.
I get that.
Yeah, I was going to say, Doug, you have anything to add to that?
No, the marrying into Japanese life, sometimes it feels, it gives you a new connection to it, because you get to experience a side that a lot of travelers don't get to see.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I should sort of preface this by saying, since we're still fairly early in the show, that I'm not fluent in Japanese by any stretch of the imagination. I don't even claim to speak Japanese, really. I can get by with survival Japanese. I'm terrible at learning languages, but I'm really good at kind of accents and mimicry. So when I am traveling, I literally put on a French accent or Italian accent or a Japanese accent, get by with a bit of, you know, Japanese words mixed in with some English, what little I know. And it's surprising how far you can get. So, I'm not fully immersed or been assimilated into Japanese society. But again, you know, from a traveling perspective, and I know that a lot of people get concerned about the language, you know, we can chat about that later, but it's something which, you know, I'm not proud of, but, you know, it's just, I'm not great with languages. It just doesn't go in. I still do my Duolingo classes every day on my app, but, you know, it's, I'm hoping that by some sort of process of drip over time, digital osmosis, it'll go in. But, you know, I do struggle, but, you know, hey, we can't all be perfect.
Yeah. And that's something that, you know, we all on this podcast, we've done multiple episodes now on language. We're all striving to get there as well. So I think we're all in the same boat, you know. And
I mean, comfortable company.
Yes, yep. Indeed,
definitely.
And I have one quick one before we move on to the next question. Favorite Japanese film director? The old, the classics, the masters.
Probably Ozu, actually. Yeah, Ozu, okay. I was dabbling in filmmaking because I had this big interest in film when I was at school and a teenager, and I started making short films and stuff. And I made this kind of really cheesy horror film. It was more like a thriller, really. But in my mind, when I conceived it with my friend, we conceived it as a cheesy horror film, but it actually became quite stylish and classy, sort of. and I kept looking at the shots that I was framing, and I just realized I was doing loads of framing like Ozu would. So I was doing lots of things where the camera was on the floor looking across the room at people, so you could see them full height or sat on the floor because they were at a distance. And it was just kind of like a weird juxtaposition, because I was a big, like, trashy horror movie fan as well, mixing that with like this classic Japanese cinema. So, yeah, that was a bit strange.
Wow. And do you still have that film?
I do. Oh, I do, but it hasn't seen the light of day. Probably to the benefit of the world.
It's in the archives, right?
Yeah, we'll get that digitized. We'll get that up on social media.
Maybe a bonus download.
Yeah, there you go. We'll make a Patreon, and then that'll be
that's a good idea. Yeah, maybe I'll be up for that then.
The top tier.
Exactly.
Is to be able to watch that. All right. Well. So let's shift our focus a little bit more towards what our topic was for today. And, you know, that topic was, as Nigel had mentioned earlier, off the beaten path options in, you know, in Japan, for travelers that, you know, things that they may not be aware of. And for this specific episode, we're focusing on Kansai. Mm-hmm. We wanted to ask you, what were some of your experiences traveling within the Kansai region? And, you know, how would you compare that to other regions like Kanto or Tohoku or, you know, the other areas of the country?
Yeah, so I mentioned my wife's family. They live in a small city not far from Kobe, which itself is not far from Osaka. So that's Kansai's biggest city. and where Kansai International Airport is. So we'd often fly from the UK directly into Kansai Airport. And so I quickly got to know the region from exploring it via sort of short breaks and day trips, and because we had, you know, relatives in the area, that kind of thing. A lot of my wife's childhood friends were in the area, so we had a lot of friends that we would network with who were in the Kansai region. So that's kind of that was the anchor point, I guess. And neither my wife nor I drive. So we're pretty good at getting around Japan using public transport, or, you know, hiring taxis or whatever we might need to do. And Kansai is actually sort of really well served by railway lines. I mean, I know a lot of Japan is, but and of course you get the multiple train companies. So within the bigger cities, it's not uncommon to find, you know, stops on the line that are served by three train companies and have three train stations, each run by a, you know, a different a company. So what I guess I enjoy most about traveling in Kansai is that of all the prefectures, particularly, I would say across the whole of Japan, to me, it feels like a microcosm of most of what Japan has to offer, in terms of experiences, in terms of landscape, you know, the food, the culture, the variety of it all, I should say. I guess the biggest thing that it doesn't really offer is the experience that you get from Japan's most southwesterly islands, like from Kyushu, Okinawa and beyond, which have a very different kind of subtropical climate and a kind of chilled out vibe about them. So, yeah, I think the other regions, the rest of the regions are almost more distinctive than Kansai. Kansai, that's what I mean by, you know, to me, it feels like a microcosm of the, particularly Honshu as a whole. You've got elements of the things that you can see in the different parts of Japan in the Kansai region. So you've got, you know, your plains, you've got mountains, you've got your coast, you've got your cities, you know, big bustling cities, you've got your quiet mountain retreats, all this kind of variety. Whereas in other regions, you know, they're dominated by big cities or built up areas, or, you know, the rural farmlands, or, you know, the central mountains, that kind of thing. So it's good bang for your buck, if you like. If people want to travel and, you know, are limited in their time, you can cover a lot of, you know, the experience of Japan, if you like, by just traveling around the Kansai region, I would say.
Yeah, I've been there, I want to say maybe two or three times during my various stays in Japan. And, you know, it's got a lot to offer for sure. I mean, you know, we're going to touch on a lot of that, obviously. But yeah, it's such a fascinating region. And I guess my perception is that Kansai, and maybe it's just Osaka, is kind of like trendy, or like kind of like the image of it is, it's cool. You know, it's the coolest region of all, you know, like of all the regions, like all the comedians and the famous, like a lot of famous actors or celebrities come from that area. So it's kind of like the, you know, where they start or get their, you know, get their beginnings.
Yeah. And I think that's right. And Osaka sort of prides itself on, you know, being distinctly different, particularly from, there's a bit of rivalry between Osaka and Tokyo. You know, and Osakans are really kind of proud of, you know, their culture and their, you know, their local dialect. What little Japanese I can speak, when I travel around Japan, and like when we visit friends in Tokyo, for example, they say my pronunciation, they think I've got a kind of Osaka sound to my pronunciation. And that's obviously because I spent so much time there and we've still got friends there. And that's where I must be speaking a lot of my Japanese. It must be all the time I've spent there. But yeah, it's got a really good vibe about it. And it's a big kind of foodie city as well. They really pride themselves on their food, but it has got a really, you know, it's kind of like, you know, I talked about the Southern Islands being really chilled, have a chilled vibe. Osaka has got that, you know, but it's a bustling city as well. But it has got a kind of, alternative kind of culture, if you like, about it. And there's Amerimura, is it Amerikamura? There's a district, you know, that's kind of really funky and influenced by the West, and they've got lots of cool bars and cafes and that kind of thing. And, you know, I think Osaka does that kind of stuff really well. It's got a lot of character, and it's kind of like, you know, if you're kind of, you know, if you're a young traveler, it'll be a great place to spend a lot of time. You know, there's, you know, for young people to hang out and bars and places to eat, it's just, you know, you really are spoiled for choice there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was going to ask Doug, when was the first time you actually went, or your first encounter with the Kansai region? You said you've been there twice.
Yeah, now that I'm thinking about it a little bit more, I've probably been there about five times. But the first time, they kind of blend in together sometimes. But the first time I went was during study abroad. A friend of mine's family was lived in Nishinomiya, outside of, is that outside of Kobe, I believe?
Yeah, that's right. It's just between Kobe and Osaka.
Yeah. So I went to his house and stayed with his family for a couple days because I had this great planned adventure of, I'm going to go do the Shikoku pilgrimage during my spring break. That was my plan. That I got to the first temple and then it ended up ending right there. I went back and it was too cold still in March when I went. So
you were still used to that New Orleans humidity.
Yeah. So, but that was my first time going there because I got the experience like Kobe. I went to Himeji. I believe we went to Osaka. I can't remember. We definitely went to Nara. And then later on that year, same year, I started dating a girl who lives in Osaka. So, you know, I went down there for a trip to catch up with her. So yeah, that was the first couple times I went, and I got to see Kyoto as well. I think on the second trip.
Wow.
So I did kind of the circuit the first couple trips around and then kind of rehashed it, the next couple times I went.
I gotcha. So, and Rob, was your first time going to Kobe? First time visiting Kansai, the Kansai region?
Yeah, I guess so. Cause it was really, you know, to go back and see family originally. Well, every time we've been to Japan, we always traveled as part of that journey, because obviously it's a long way from the UK, so we wanted to max out our time there. But so we flew into Kansai, which is in, you know, the harbour, Osaka Bay. So it's in Osaka, and, you know, Kobe to Osaka, it's like 20 minutes on the train. It's not a long way away. Kobe was, to me, my wife's city is just next door to Nishinomiya, actually, Doug. So I know Nishinomiya as well.
There you go.
So Kobe is kind of like another hometown to me. I mean, I know it like the back of my hand. So I'm a big advocate for Kobe. So, you know, if I hadn't been so ambitious to have the real Japan, I'd probably do a site called The Real Kobe, because I love that place. Wow. So, yeah, I like it there. So, Kobe is kind of like my second home almost, really. And it's a great place, because around Osaka, I mean, we can touch on this later, but around Osaka, you've got Kansai International Airport, but you've also got Itami Airport. So there's a lot of airports there. And then they built an airport in Kobe, not that it needed one, you know, about 20 years ago or something. And so there's loads of connectivity in that region. You can get to pretty much anywhere in the whole of the Japanese island chain from Kansai. So it's great as a kind of hub. And if you look at it, you know, on the main island of Honshu, it sits at that kind of pivot point between the northern part of the island and then the southern side, when you get down to Shikoku and then the first of the southern islands like Kyushu. So it really sits at like a nexus in the whole of Honshu. And maybe that's why, you know, almost like it absorbs bits from the other part of the country. I don't know, I'm kind of making this stuff up, but you know, it has got that kind of, it really does sit in that pivot point of the whole of the main island.
Yeah, I mean, you make a really good point there, because it does. I mean, if you flew, I always fly into Tokyo, because where my wife's family is from is in Ibaraki, so it's, you know, easier to fly in there, obviously. But I mean, if you fly into Osaka and you're planning on doing like a trip like around the country, it's definitely much more central. You get much more of a pick your poison, pick your direction if you go there. Whereas in Tokyo, you have, if you wanted to make the southern trip, it's a pretty big trek, you know?
Yeah, that's a great point, actually. And when I'm working with people on their travel plans, you know, they've sometimes got the option to fly into Tokyo or Kansai. And sometimes, depending on what they want to do on their trip, Kansai is the better option for precisely that reason. They can immediately jump on, get a rail pass and jump on a Shinkansen and then pick up a load of places in a very short amount of time. Whereas if they fly into Tokyo and they want to go north, maybe they want to go up to Hokkaido, they're probably just going to get straight on a plane and then fly up to Hokkaido and then start to wend their way down using maybe the bullet trains. So, yeah, I mean, it's a great option. So if people have the chance to fly into Kansai International instead of Tokyo, and they've already been to Japan a few times, I would say, perhaps more for those that have been once or twice and, know Tokyo and the basics, certainly consider flying into Kansai International, because it does give you a load of immediate options, whether that's in the immediate vicinity in and around Osaka, or whether it's then spidering out to the rest of the mainland of Honshu, or even to the, the wider islands.
Yeah, yeah. And so, I think we've been talking around this subject, but now let's just dive into the planning a trip to Kansai. Because we've touched on certain elements of, using trains and getting there. But I think when most people think of going to Kansai, let's say for a first time trip, there is one place that they think of before any other, probably, and that is Kyoto. And now, because of its, its history, cultural importance, that's fair.
Sure.
Kyoto was the second major capital of Japan, and was that for nearly 400 years. I believe the official number is like 391. But it's a very, very important city, but there's a big but there is much more to Kansai. And you've written about this on your blog, which, shout out, Rob has a fantastic blog on the Real Japan website that you should totally check out. And you've written about, how to travel, around Kansai and not to Kyoto. But we have to have at least one question. For those who do go for the first time and they want to travel to Kyoto, how would you approach visiting the city in a way that truly takes advantage of the off the beaten path and non-touristy sites and experiences?
Yeah. I mean, it's a great question, and it's a totally legitimate place to go because it's fantastic, and it's definitely worth visiting and revisiting and revisiting. And that's what's great about it, particularly the wider city. It's a fairly compact city center, but then it kind of spiders out, I guess. But I think there's no single right answer that works for everybody. But I think this is almost true of all travel in Japan, really, or maybe even all travel. So it's obviously all dependent on what individuals' interests and preferences are. But obviously spending time research is going to help. But the way I would suggest people approach it is to be kind of open-minded and be almost like a magpie about it and collect ideas and pick things up from a variety of sources and then kind of absorb all that and make it your own. So essentially what I would suggest people do, and in fact, this is how I approach not just Kyoto, but all my travel in Japan. I use my little Rodia notebooks that I buy in Japan, and the back page of my little pocket Rodia notebook has always got my ideas for my next trip. Literally just, I've seen a cafe on a blog, I'm going to write that cafe name down. Like there's some cafes in Kyoto that I absolutely adore and I always go back to. And it's just from, stumbling across them when walking off the beaten path a little bit, put them in my notebook so I don't forget. So literally keep notes all the time. So make a long list of possibilities and then start to dig deeper. So the other thing to factor in is you do need to factor in some practical steps, like, how are you going to get there? How long is it going to take to travel? Because if you are going to start to sort of explore beyond the city center, then you do need to think about some of those practical things, particularly if you're time constrained. Some people I know, I've got subscribers who have been to Japan on their first trip, maybe 2 weeks, and they spend a bulk of that, like a week in Tokyo with a few day trips out, and then the second week in Kyoto. But often they're actually kind of just exploring the city center. They're not really generally pushing the boundaries. And actually Kyoto is one of the cities that once you just start to go beyond the boundaries of the city center, but the wider prefecture and the area around it, it has actually got a lot of, again, variety, that word, but to offer. So when I'm doing my travel planning services for my clients, I ask them to complete a personal questionnaire. So I would do this even if I was, and I still do this myself. I still revisit. I've got a pattern that I work to. So anyone can do this themselves. But basically, think about their specific travel interests, preferences, you know, likes and dislikes. And then I use a rating system to grade their responses so that I and they know where we need to prioritize and how we should approach building a trip. And that's whether it's, you know, 3 weeks in Japan as a whole, or whether it's even down to a single destination, this approach works. So aside from going to therealjapan.com and searching for the word Kyoto to get some ideas, I would say go local. And what I mean by that is search online for Kyoto residents that blog or have a YouTube channel about the city. And they're usually really passionate and speak about and focus on their neighborhood. And their neighborhood, 9 times out of 10, is not going to be in the city center. It's going to be, you know, in the South Ward or in the Northern Ward. There's lots in the North that a lot of people don't get to explore. You look at this and Kyoto, there's actually quite, I mean, because it's such a draw, a lot of people internationally end up living there. So a lot of people who blog or have YouTube channels about this are non-Japanese. And they've got a slightly different perspective that international travelers, I think, can relate to more. And that's literally what I do when I plan in my trip. So I research for inspiration or to find more about places or experiences or whatever it might be that I've already identified, and then think about how much time I want to make available and what I can then fit into that time. So, you're going to need to plan ahead. Things to think about would be like check for dates and times of infrequent experiences that you might want to pick up. So in Kyoto, for example, there are some monthly flea markets that happen in the Shinto shrines, but they're only monthly and they're only on certain days. So you need to kind of know that in advance. And I have literally planned travel to Kyoto to coincide with things like markets. Obviously, festivals in Japan is a huge thing. But obviously, bear in mind that when it's festivals, they're particularly popular with Japanese travelers as well. And the best accommodation around festival dates, you know, really can get booked out months in advance. So unless you're planning on doing a day trip in and out of the city to partake, or if you're staying in the city around a festival period, you know, you're going to want to book your accommodation well in advance. But draw up a list of your must-see places and decide how many days you'll need to see those. And then here's the crucial bit, and this is what I say all the time, and wherever you are in Japan, but particularly in the major cities, the popular cities, I should say, like Tokyo and like Kyoto, is be prepared to wander. You've got to allow time for serendipity to happen. And that's almost kind of an oxymoron, do you know what I mean? But you need to give your travel that space to have these experiences. Because honestly, most of the off the beaten track stuff that I've experienced over my 20 plus years of travel in Japan is thinking, oh, Kyoto is a great place to go. I'll go to Kyoto. But when I get there, I'm going to do some of the basics. Sure, I'll do those. But then I always allow time to just wander. So I might find, you know, a cafe or something, and it might be in the northern part of the city that's the draw. I'll go to, and we'll book a cafe, we'll go, or a restaurant, we'll go there, and then we'll keep the afternoon free, and we'll literally just go out and start to wander. And I think, you know, it takes time to wander. It's a kind of a, time's obviously precious, particularly to travellers when they're visiting the country. But even in a single day, you can plan to have an hour of unscheduled time. You know, I get people send me their draft itineraries for vetting, for example, and you know, people draft down to the nth degree, and I mean, I'm amazed that they're so capable. I mean, that's really impressive stuff. But also, you want to sometimes say to them, look, you know, you've got a really busy schedule that week. Allow an entire afternoon where, you know, you're in Kyoto, but you literally don't have any plans. And what you do is you ask at the reception of your hotel. If you go to a cafe or you find a restaurant that you really like and you get chatting to staff, ask the staff. Shopkeepers are a great source of information, so chat to them. You know, find a spot in the city that looks interesting, arrive there and just start to wander. And then when you get to Kyoto, most people are going to be traveling there by train. So if you're arriving in Kyoto by train, don't head off first without pausing to take in the station, because it's incredible architecture.
Yeah, and
it's one of these weird things. You get off the platform, you go through the gates, and it's open to the elements. So you walk in, it's covered, but it's open. So you walk inside, and you're inside this huge atrium that's about, I think it's over 12 stories high. And it's covered, but both sides are kind of open to the elements. It's an amazing place. So it's really airy. And there's escalators inside. So you can go up these escalators when you're in the main concourse area of the on the ground floor. But these escalators go all the way to the roof of the station. And you can get up on the roof of Kyoto Station and then look over the city about what you're about to explore. I mean, it's a great experience. I mean, if you're into architecture, or even if you're not into architecture and you just like great views, that's a great thing to pause and do when you arrive. And then what I would suggest, if I want to give some specific pointers, I would say my favorite of exploring around it is to head to the north of the city. Not least because if it's a busy time, obviously we're in the pandemic still. But you know, Kyoto will get busy pretty quickly again. But if you're looking for much of the same experiences but fewer crowds, just as rewarding sights, and depending on what your interests are, I would say head north, plan a few places to see, and then work your way back into the city centre, gradually working your way down, and you can see the sights that way. Right in the north, you've got King Kakuji, the Golden Pavilion, which is an absolutely glorious place to see, you know, whatever the season. And that's right in the north. And that's a great thing to use as an anchor point and then work your way down. But not far from there is a fantastic tea ceremony experience up there. There's a company called Camellia, named after the flower. And they've got two tea rooms, one in the city centre, but they've got one called Garden, which is in that northern area. And it's literally about 5 minutes walk from the Golden Pavilion. So those are two things that you could coincide and do and then work your way back down. And then there's a really nice shrine that goes through woodland and a natural stream called Kamigamo Shrine in the north. And again, just around the corner from there, there's a really nice kind of vegan cafe called Stardust, which is, you know, really unusual, a little boutique. It's got like a shop at the front and then a cafe at the back, and they do raw food and stuff like this. And there's a, once you get slightly more into, I forget the name of the district, but it's in the northern half, you're getting into towards the city centre, there's a restaurant called Sekiyuba, which only serves yuba, which is tofu skin. So it's dishes, the entire cuisine, the entire menu is yuba, tofu skin. So there's all these little gems of places that you can just find if you just kind of allow time for these things to be discovered.
Wow. I mean, I think that was probably one of the most helpful like travel advice, like responses we've ever gotten. I mean, I think you covered all the bases of, you know, how to actually not just, you know, go check out this place, but actually conceptually how to plan a trip effectively and how to maximize on the time that you have to ensure that you not only just hit this one place, you know, but you have the philosophy of how to apply off the beaten path travel options in any city you go to. So phenomenal.
Yeah, that's what's powerful about the approach. Yeah.
Wow. So Rob gave us a lot to unpack, not just about the, you know, philosophy of doing the off the beaten path traveling, but also his story as well. And so one of the things, you know, I found really interesting is kind of Rob and his wife's origin story of meeting through doing a Depeche Mode pen pal system thing. What did you think about that?
That was pretty incredible. I think back to the 90s, and I mean, I wasn't a part of a fan club or anything like that, but I just remember, you know, obviously magazines were huge, and I was a big wrestling nerd back in middle school. And I remember in the backs of those wrestling magazines, they would have like these like fan clubs and like write into editors and stuff like that. And then but being able to connect. And before internet was bigger, you know, obviously at that point they still had like some chat rooms and some things, but internet wasn't what we know as internet. So there was a lot of limitations there. But, you know, the fact that you were able to connect with someone to the level of eventually becoming, you know, their spouse through pen paling is pretty incredible.
Yeah. And I wonder, missed opportunities here, I guess, but I wonder if like the letters between them, like if it's like documented, you know, like, cause whether was the correspondence in the magazine or like, were they just sending like letters to themselves? Like that'd be really interesting.
Yeah. I gotta imagine they probably were just, they, I don't know if they funneled them through, like, yeah, that's a good question. We probably should ask that. Like, is it something where, and this, again, we're focused on something that's not even anything to do with like that actual like, travel, but still, it's such a cool story.
It's because you and I are having this conversation. Yeah. We're getting sidetracked already.
But no, I wish I had asked. Maybe we'll do this for a follow-up episode.
Yeah.
But if they, to get those pen pal letters, like, did they have to funnel them through the fan club and then they redirected them to the person's address? Because I'm sure for privacy's sake, they couldn't just give people addresses, right? So.
Right.
So, yeah.
That's
and then eventually once you make that initial connection, then you have your address on the envelope. So maybe that's how you, you know, initiate the conversation.
Yeah.
And in the correspondence, I guess, subsequent ones.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's really interesting. Maybe we'll have to reach out. I'm sure Rob's listening. You know, we'll have to, if you hear this, Rob, let us know. Let us know on Twitter or something like that, you know?
Yeah. We can go on IG Live or something and tell them more of the story.
Right.
No, it's funny too, because like, you know, that I don't want, without getting too deep and, you know, side storied out here. Like I had a similar thing with my wife, you know, like I lived in Japan for 4 years, three of those teaching and in Fukushima. And I came back home after JET. And just happened to go to like a local Japanese restaurant that I became friends with a lot of the patrons there, and we're going there often, and met her there. She was working at the restaurant, and then we became friends. And over a couple of years, you know, over the course of a few years, we started, you know, eventually started dating and whatnot. But then when we started dating, that's when I found out, oh, wait, you were literally 45 minutes away from my old apartment. Like your mom's house is 45 minutes away from my old apartment.
Wow.
So it's just like kind of like crazy small world stuff. It's not like a pen pal, but just how you connect and meet people is just so wild sometimes.
yeah definitely. And speaking of wild, how about him and his wife's story of coming to New Orleans for the first time, and I guess the only time, but having a police car pull up next to their cab, and the guy rolls over the hood, you know, and like, and you know, police pursues him, you know, I mean, what a welcome to New Orleans, I guess.
Yeah, apparently nothing's changed in however many years.
Yeah, I was like, that's a great advertisement for our city.
I guess, well, technically the airport changed.
Yeah.
You got the new MSY, which actually really nice.
It is actually.
Really nice.
Yeah.
Still nice?
Still nice. We'll see how long that lasts.
Yeah, well, I guess it's the nice list is a little prolonged by the pandemic and not being able to travel too much. So I didn't get destroyed by... frequent travelers and stuff like that.
Yeah, like I said, we'll see how long that lasts, but nevertheless, you know, I mean, what a very interesting welcome to the city that, like you said, confirmed the kind of fears and the stories that they were seeing in the news at the time, but still they had a good time. So
it gives you a memory, right? You know, something that you, when you go to other cities, you may not remember things. Maybe like, yeah, I traveled through there, blah, blah, blah. And you went to New Orleans. Yeah. So I was welcomed at the airport by a police chase. You know, that's something pretty memorable.
And more evidence that maybe Rob's life is a movie, you know, it's a Truman Show or Matrix type combination there going on. But there's some more evidence.
I think the part that airport arrival that hit me hardest at home, and I mentioned this in the actual interview itself, was the coming out of the airport and being punched in the face with that humidity and the heat. Like, especially if you come in the summer and you're coming from somewhere where it's maybe not as humid, it's just crazy. And to be honest, you're on the plane, you're on, you know, AC. In the airport, you're on AC. But that, even the jetway, like, you get off the plane, you're like, holy crap. You know, this is what I'm into. This is where I'm at. you get a nice wake up call.
Yeah. Yeah. No, definitely. So, you know, that takes us on to, you know, discussing really, I guess, you know, the core theme of this episode, which was talking about off the beaten path travel. And this episode is just part one of two. So we didn't dive too deep into it just yet. But where we ended our interview, Rob had just given us kind of a breakdown of the philosophy behind off the beaten path travel, which I thought was really interesting because I think a lot of times, you know, people will just tell you the things to see off the beaten path. But it's kind of that, you know, that saying out there, you know, give a man a fish, he eats for a day, teach a man to fish, he eats for a lifetime, you know, and that's what I really appreciated about that segment because the things that he shared, it was the kind of the tips and tricks and how to mentally plan no matter where you're going, if it's Kansai, if it's Japan in general, or if it's Europe or Latin America, Africa, you know, who knows? But I thought that was really interesting. And I just want to go through some of the things that he mentioned as part of the philosophy of off the beaten path travel. And one of those things was bringing a notebook to jot down stuff that you find interesting, you know, or want to, you know, come back and try later.
Yeah.
When you're out there, you know, maybe exploring the main sites, or, you know, if you're on a bus or transit, you see something, jotting it down in a notebook. Is that something that you've done in your travels?
You know, I did for one trip. So I did the 88 Temple pilgrimage a couple times, and, you know, over two separate trips in Shikoku. And I brought a notebook for that trip, but that was more to kind of document where I went. Not so much to like plan for a future trip. So yes and no. I mean, it made sense because now I can go back and I actually still have that notebook. So I can go back and read. I was earlier in the year reading through my stuff and I was like, oh, this is really cool. I'm so glad I wrote some of the stuff down just because, and that was Facebook also was in its, not infancy, but Facebook mobile was in its infancy. There, apps were in iPhones were just starting to drop. Oh my God, I'm aging myself a lot here.
So you still had a MySpace out there then?
No. I had a Mixi account, which is like the Japanese MySpace or kind of like MySpace.
Is it still out there?
I think it is. Mine? I don't know. Yeah. I don't even remember my login or password. They actually, it's probably out there somewhere.
We got to go find it.
No. but I remember I would update also after a while. I did my journal while I was starting, but then it got to be a little tedious and I'd started to fall behind. So instead I started to like kind of go on Facebook mobile and post every time we made it to a certain place or did something or met somebody really interesting, you know, documented it that way. And I thought that was really cool to do that. Cause again, it gives you something to look back at towards your trip. That's not just a picture or something, because it documents some of the detail of the trip that pictures can't capture. So whether you use a notebook for documenting that stuff for future travel or for yourself, I think it's a great idea just in general.
Yeah. Yeah. Same. And that's kind of, he also mentioned it in that capacity too, because let's say you try something during your time there and you journal it. He mentioned that there's cafes in Kyoto, or a specific one that, you know, he tried once and, you know, he wrote it down and now he tries it every time he goes. So, you know, I could definitely see even the power in using a notebook just to journal your experiences, because let's say you don't have that and you go, you do an off the beaten path adventure on your own and you don't write anything down. You don't remember the name of the place you went to, the people you met, you know. So when you do bring that notebook, I could definitely see the utility in that. And I bring notebooks, but I never end up journaling.
So, you know, that's the thing too with like phones, especially smartphones now. A lot of people like won't use notebooks or don't like the fact that you have to carry around a notebook and a pen to document like crap. So I get that. But I feel like I could put something on my like notes app or whatever for my iPhone. But
Yeah.
How often do I actually go back and look at that shit? That's the thing. Like, I'll put it there and then I go back and I'm like, man, that's right. I forgot I had that there. You know, I mean, some people will use it more religiously than I do, but I feel like having a hard copy of something written down. Now you could lose that and lose everything, you know, forever. If it something happened to it,
but
having that hard thing, I don't know. I like having it in hand, not some like digitized copy of something. I mean, that's just, I kind of go the same way with books too, though.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and that's totally valid. For me, like I said, I bring the journals because I want to, I just never end up doing it. But what I find really helps me is the Google Maps app. You can drop pins and like save locations and, you know, places, and you can customize them and, you know, give them certain tags and group them. I end up doing that a lot more than I do journaling, because 9 times out of 10, I have my Maps app open.
Yeah, exactly. Like when you're traveling, I know when I'm traveling, I look Google Maps up all the time. Just to see what's around, you know, like when I would go to visit my in-laws in Ibaraki, I would pick a random point, like a temple or a shrine or someplace, you know, some ways away. And I would run there. That would be my exercise. Like something that's like 3 or 4 kilometers away. I'd pick that point, run there, and then run back. But then I would take a different route going there and then coming back. Yeah. I got lost a couple times. and you know, Google Maps will send you on a road that doesn't exist, or like say like, oh, you can follow this. And then,
Oh, yes.
Especially in Japan. Indeed. I run into that more often than not, especially off the beaten path, literally. No, Google Maps is like a godsend. Yeah. If you prefer not to go the route of a notebook, I think it's such a handy tool.
Yeah. And it doesn't give you the luxury of maybe, you know, writing down, you know, a whole account of what you did in that day. But, you know, there's a limited mobility to kind of track what you did. And if you really use it to the full extent, you can actually organize it by day, by, you know, by colors. And, you know, you can, it can be really useful. And like I said, I end up going back and looking at a city I've been to, and I see all the places that I went, and that triggers the memories for me, you know. But it's different for everybody, you know, and that's valid. So one of the other things that Rob mentioned was, you know, using local people and recommendations, the people who live in a city, looking on the internet, you know, beyond just, you know, TripAdvisor or, I don't know, a guidebook that you could get in the store, but also just searching on the internet to see what are people who live here vlogging about and saying that they're doing here. You know, what are people blogging, like actually physically writing about, you know, is that something that I definitely do. I think that is probably like my bread and butter, you know, of figuring out things to do.
YouTube? No way. You like YouTube?
One day I will convert you to being a YouTube user, fan, YouTubeite? I don't know.
YouTubian?
Yeah, YouTubian. There we go. We'll go with that one. I mean, there's so much content out there that can be so helpful. And I find it's much more useful to actually see videos sometimes than just see like still photos on a website describing it. I like to see, you know,
the videos will give you, especially those video blogs that give you a tour of a place or something like that. That way you know what to look for, not just one site, but like the surrounding sites, like landmarks and things like that to be paying attention to.
Right.
I fully agree with that. I think that's really important. I know when I was on JET, and whenever I'd go on trips, I would ask my teachers that I worked with, I'd say, hey, I'm planning on going to X, you know, like I'm going here for a weekend. Have you been there before? Or ask around and get recommendations. Cause again, especially if I was traveling inside of Fukushima, like a lot of people had family in other parts of the area. They came to Iwaki cause there was a lot of teaching opportunities there, but maybe their family's from north or west or whatever. So I would ask and get recommendations. And I think that's really a great, great, great resource that sometimes as a tourist, you may not have when you're in Japan,
But if you're able to do a little bit of that research, and again, like you said, with YouTube and with blogs now, there's a lot more resources out there. But I also, you know, Google is another thing, like Google Maps, like just if you know where you're going to be, kind of zoom in that area, and then to the point where you start to see names and things like that pop up on the map.
Yeah.
And then see, look at the reviews. I mean, I don't know if they're going to be all of them in English or in Japanese or what, but it's just one of those things too. You might be able to find something funky or unique that you otherwise wouldn't have found.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I love doing that, you know, just pinching out on the, you know, the phone and seeing what restaurants are in the area. You can discover so much that way for sure. That also brings me to one of the points he mentioned, which was planning around festivals, you know, and just, I would say, events in general that are going on in a place that you're traveling to. That is massive, you know.
One thing, especially if you know you're going to a certain area, a lot of cities will have, one, they'll have their city websites and they'll have their city calendars.
Yeah.
Sometimes they will be in English and in Japanese. So you'll be able to leverage that going to those cities' websites. Because if you go to just the general tourist places and whatnot, they're not necessarily going to cover all these small towns and villages and mm-hmm. cities. You know, they're going to hit on mainly the bigger things. So if you know a town that you're going to be around, or you know you want to go over there, check the calendars out, especially if you're going in the end of July, early August, you know, early to middle of August. A lot of those times they have a lot of festivals in small areas that you wouldn't see otherwise unless you look at those city calendars. So I always, and this is when we go back to visit in-laws, it's usually at the end of July, the beginning of August, because there's a lot of, first of all, a lot of people are out of work for, you know, when we go visit, but also there's a lot of cool festivals going on. And we always try to attend like where my mommy's family's, you know, area has like a small little dance festival that goes on. And then I try to go up to Iwaki for a couple of the local festivals I used to attend when I was on JET. So it's really, really, really cool. And again, city websites and also their Facebook pages, because sometimes they'll have international divisions that will translate newsletters and things like that. And they kind of pinpoint those opportunities for like kind of like festival sightseeing and whatnot into English for the local foreigners in their areas.
Yeah. Yeah. And I feel like that's another area where you're trying to figure out, you know, what type of local festival things are going on. That's another area where, you know, looking up local people who actually live in those areas, you know, searching for, you know, influencers, not just influencers, but people who are just sharing their lives, you know, in that city that you're going to, or that region or your town, wherever, you know. I always, if I'm going to a place, I Google events going on, you know, in such and such. And from there, that usually leads me to those people who are vlogging or making content about it. So definitely top.
Yeah. And the cool thing too is Twitter.
Yeah.
If you go on and you know the town you're going to be in, whether it's a hashtag or actually just searching, but if you put like Matsuri and the name of the town, usually you'll be able to pull up something, and it's most likely or not pictures, you know, or links to a calendar or event page or something like that. So just knowing how to search and find those things is probably the most important part.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. So the last topic that I want to touch on here before we end this part one, is something absolutely huge that Rob mentioned, which was being prepared to wander. In other words, planning time in your schedule to not have a plan. And I think that is probably one of the most essential aspects of off the beaten path travel. If you plan absolutely everything, then you don't leave time to have some of those experiences where you find an alleyway and you see something down there that's interesting to you, but you can't go down there because you have something else planned you have to get to. And you know, you have to plan that time in there for that. So that is something that I try to be conscious of whenever I plan a trip somewhere. How about you?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely one of those things that I try to do it. And sometimes I'll have no, I guess like when I go visit in-laws, and again, I say this because this was like when we were going pre-COVID, it was like once a year usually. So we would have about 2 weeks when we had maybe 7 or 8 days planned out, like, and I would have about a half a week where I can kind of like, or maybe a little bit more than that, that I could do kind of what I wanted to do, or like find, you know, flexibility to meet up with friends, or if something was going on in Tokyo that I wanted to go see. Like 1 year I impromptu went and saw a New Japan Pro Wrestling like event live, managed to find tickets online last second. So, you know, this, I always try to do that. So, you know, you got to accommodate and allow for that. And I think the most intimidating part is, like Rob kind of mentioned this too on the call, is like understanding that you could be just wandering around and you don't know what you're going to be doing. And
yeah. And with the language barrier too.
Language barrier, but you know, people are afraid to waste time on these trips, or if you don't find something, it's considered a wasted moment, yeah. You know, wasted afternoon. Yeah. And I know a lot of people want to try, especially when you have a limit on how long you can travel for. You know, you may be taking away time from somewhere else that you really want to see. So it is a risk reward type situation, yeah. But that's where you kind of go into it. You allow yourself with no plan, but know where you're going to be. So that way you can have an idea of what's in the area and then kind of play it by ear.
Yeah, that makes sense. So instead of just like saying, I'm literally not going to do anything like in terms of a plan, you know, perhaps plan to get yourself to a certain area and then, you know, from there, just wander and explore.
Yeah.
You know, and that's how I usually try to do it. You know, I don't just say, you know, okay, you know, eat lunch and then nothing, you know,
yeah.
I'll eat lunch and then I will look at a certain area of town and say, okay, I'll just want to go to that area of town and explore and see what happens, you know? So you can do it with the guidelines.
Yeah.
But it's so true. So valid. I think there's a huge fear of I'm going to waste my time, my precious time traveling, you know? And like I said, that's valid because that makes sense. You know, you work hard, you finally make it to where you want to be. You don't want to miss things.
Yeah.
I think if you listen to what Rob is saying, you know, you can see that there is a method of doing it that makes sense, you know, and you can plan it. And like we said, plan to not have a plan. Don't just not have a plan, but plan to not have a plan. And that's the key.
And sometimes, I mean, I would, these types of things I would usually reserve for, and this is just me personally, because I enjoy a fun night out. You know, I would reserve it for kind of walking around areas that have like karaoke or drinking places and stuff where you can kind of see what's going on, and you never know what's going to, you never know what your night's going to bring for you.
Exactly.
I can't tell you how many times, you know, friends and I have gone walking through like city centers of smaller towns, and you just kind of listen for karaoke and singing. And then you're like, okay, that sounds kind of fun. Let's see what happens. And then right. You never know. You meet a group of people, and then they take you to, you know, Nijikai somewhere else where you're going and end up staying out until 4 or 5 in the morning, having a blast and making friends with people you never know.
Right.
I mean, this is, and I'm not going to sidetrack too much. This happened when I went with Maddie and Sam to Matsue for the exchange program back in 2019. Our last night there, we didn't have plans. We went to dinner. And then after that, it was kind of like a free night. It was our last night in Matsue. And we went with some of the CIRs that were working there and helping kind of guide and translate for us, walking around. We ended up going to I think it was a host bar. But it was like a host bar in the front, but the back had like tables and darts and karaoke. And so you could go and participate in the host bar stuff, or you can just kind of go in the back and just do your own thing and do like a nomi hodai. And we ended up doing that. And then there was like groups that would kind of come in throughout the night, and there was like 3 tables. And then we would rotate who did karaoke. And the people next to us, it would rotate again, tables coming in and out all night, but we made friends and exchanged business cards and stuff with like these random people and just silly conversations that once in, you know, you're never going to meet them again.
probably. You never know. But like those kind of things, I live for that kind of stuff. I love that. Like those relationships you make, micro friendships, you know, like it's so cool. You know, live in the moment and really enjoy it. But you don't, if you don't allow yourself to fall into those situations, sometimes you'll never have that. And the thrill of those kind of situations that come with it.
Well, I think on that note, that's a perfect place to end our conversation, but also part one of our conversation with Rob Dyer from The Real Japan.
In the next part of this episode with Rob in our interview, we're going to step a little bit closer into certain places that you can try to get to that are off the beaten path, that are not your typical like Osaka city centers or Kyoto city centers or all these different places. We're going to discuss a little bit more about detailed places where, hey, what are your top four or five places? What are recommendations to eat? Things like that. So, you know, if you're interested in learning more about that, then the next part is definitely for you.
Thank you so much for joining us in part one of our discussion with Rob Dyer from The Real Japan. Be sure to join us in part two next week, where we take a deep dive into specific places that Rob recommends you visit in Off the Beaten Path Kansai. In the meantime, be sure to give us a follow on social media. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Crew of Japan Podcast. That's KREWEOFJAPAN Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you in part two next week. Until next time.